KaiserNetwork.org.
And our moderator, once again, George Stephanopoulos.
Thank you all. Can you all hear me? I think we have a lot of overlap from the last program, and this is really, in many ways, the flip side of what we were talking about just in the last hour and a half before we were talking about diseases which really now only exist in the developing and the poor world that have been eradicated from the more developed world. But now we're going to focus on chronic diseases that we usually think are more prevalent and are more prevalent in the developed world, things like cancer, heart disease, respiratory disease, stroke, and diabetes, but are increasingly becoming a tremendous problem for the developing world as well. In fact, they are now the number one cause of death in the developing world, except for the AIDS-ravaged nations of sub-Saharan Africa. Let me just throw out a few numbers at the start. 70% of cancer deaths are now in the developing world. 80% of demand for tobacco comes from the developing world. And the UN just reported for the first time ever, and this is something that really surprised me, there are now more people overweight than underweight in the developing world. By 2025, the World Health Organization expects that 3/4 of the diabetics are going to be coming from the third world. And 4 out of 5 of the 17 million annual cardiovascular disease deaths took place in low- and middle-income countries, and it's starting to affect younger and younger citizens of those countries. Obviously, this is a huge health problem. It is killing people every day. It's costing the global economy billions. And with that context, let me introduce our panel. You probably all know Lance Armstrong, 7-time Tour de France winner. You probably also know of his personal history overcoming cancer and of his tremendous work here in the United States now in trying to prevent cancer. Next to him is Dr. Nizal Saraf Zadragan, who is the director of the Cardiovascular Research Center in Isfahan, Iran. She started a Healthy Heart program there, which works with schools and businesses and health professionals to promote healthy lifestyles. And you're going to have to explain this later, but one of your major contributions is to adapt the Finnish model, which is really the world standard for cardiovascular disease prevention, to the realities of low- and middle-income countries. We also have Dr. Valentin Fuster, who is the president of the World Health Foundation and a professor of cardiology at Mount Sinai. He leads global efforts to have heart disease recognized as the major killer in both the developed and the developing worlds. And the WHF, under his leadership, has pioneered development of new and innovative partnerships with corporations who share this goal. And finally, to my right, Dr. Srinath Reddy, who is one of the first to warn of an impending epidemic of cardiovascular disease and diabetes in India, and has been one of the world's most proactive leaders in stemming the spread of chronic diseases. He is president of the Public Health Foundation of India and professor of cardiology at the All India Institute of Medical Sciences. Welcome to all the panelists. And Lance, let me begin with you. If you could just draw on your personal experience with the foundation here in the United States addressing cancer, what lessons do you draw from that that could be applicable to the developing world?
Well, this is on?
Yeah.
Obviously, cancer is a major killer in this country, arguably the number one killer. There, I suppose, 15 or 20 years ago, there was a stigma around cancer in this country. People didn't talk about it. They didn't share their stories. If they were sick and they were getting chemotherapy and bald and looked sick, they didn't go outside. I spent the last 15 years racing a bicycle in Europe, and I never saw somebody that was visibly undergoing chemotherapy. I guess sometimes they would come to the race and say, tell me their story, but just on the streets, very rarely. And then I think as you move beyond Europe into Africa and Asia, again, a stigma there, and also a lot of misinformation or no information because people are a little bit clueless. But the facts are the facts. As the globe develops, habits continue to go south, which they have in America. Kids become more sedentary, smoking on the increase. We know what that leads to. It leads to higher cancer rates and death rates, and tobacco is a big part of that. Tobacco would be, I mean, just in this country alone, we know that tobacco could prevent 50% of all cancers. Look at a continent like Asia. Smoking is incredibly prevalent, and there's not a lot of controls there for that, and again, not a lot of information.
Dr. Zadrigan, let me have you follow up right there on the problem of tobacco and smoking. How do you deal with it in a culture like the Iranian culture and across not only Asia, the Middle East, where it seems there really hasn't been a stigma against the use of tobacco?
Well, first I want to thank the Clinton Initiative for inviting me and giving me this opportunity to talk about this really neglected issues and health issues in everywhere around the world. Regarding tobacco, I should say the most important market now is in Asia and the Middle East area, specifically for youth, the children. And there is another emerging issue, which is the Hubble bubble, which is the water pipe. It's becoming very important and very popular. It was popular in some of these countries in the Middle East, but now it's becoming everywhere. And it's targeting women and youth as well. So it's a big problem. And how to work with this, how to combat with this, it's an issue not of education only, because it will not work. I think the problem should be solved comprehensively. I mean, it's sort of public education plus looking to the environment, having some environmental changes. You need policies. You need some good policies. Like if you look to the FCTC with the major efforts that was done by WHO, and if you implement FCTC, that will be good. Even fewer.
So why don't you explain what that is?
The FCTC is the Framework Convention Alliance for Tobacco Control that was done. It was a lot of effort and energy done by many, many countries, with WHO, with many of foundations, international foundations, NGOs, GOs, done for many years. And it was ratified. It was signed and then ratified. And I believe that the last country that ratified it was Ecuador. That was the 137th country that ratified it in July, last July. So it will become in force when it's ratified by a country. And there are many articles within FCTC. It's dealing with everything, like education, smuggling.
You know, yeah. I'm sitting here looking at Donna Shalala in my eye line, and it just makes me think about all of her efforts throughout the 1990s to work against and eventually with the tobacco companies to prevent them from targeting children with their advertisements. Is that a non-starter in the developing world, or have you had any efforts along those lines?
Well, there are some efforts. I mean, there are many articles in FCTC dealing with this. I mean, youth, selling to youth, or dealing with youth, passive smoking, secondhand smoking, all these things are dealing with youth, smoking with youth. In my idea, still, we need to reinforce these articles of FCTC. If it's done, if it's monitored, if it's evaluated to be well and properly implemented, we will have good success with tobacco control.
I want to move to the optimistic side of this and hope, but first, I'd like a little more discussion, Dr. Fuster, from you on the failures in preventing chronic disease in the developing world and what you've learned from them.
Well, I think we are first failing in the developed world. I mean, it's the number one killer when you put cardiovascular disease and stroke. And now it's a plateau, but the disease appears 6 years later compared with 3 decades ago. So we have postponed, but the prevalence is very high. The problem in the developing countries is that they are becoming westernized. You talk about tobacco. But let me add, lack of exercise, which lead to obesity. The foods that contain high carbohydrates are cheaper. So therefore, you have now a conglomerate of tobacco. The companies are getting there because they're living from here. Then we have the lack of exercise, and then we have this diet approach, which really has to change. So when you put all these three together, you can understand that 80% of the heart attacks that take place today in 2005, these are the statistics from the HMO, the last statistics, are in developing countries, 80% of the heart attacks. And the prevalence and the incidence of the disease is really increasing. So I feel very grateful, actually, and very honored to be here this morning, because this is a neglected problem with a difference in comparison with the first panel. And the great difference is economics. In the first panel, you didn't need much to have an action and to have a benefit. In cardiovascular disease, it's very expensive. And therefore...
Why is that?
To treat a heart attack, to prevent the next heart attack, the interventions that are coming in, is very expensive. And therefore, it's a silent disease that we only become aware. We only stop smoking at the moment we develop the first heart attack. And all has been silent. So it's time to really pay attention, because in 10, 15 years from now, in developing countries, it will be absolutely impossible to afford what is coming up. I mean, this is basically why I feel this panel particularly so important.
Dr. Reddy, I want to come to you and talk about diabetes in just a second. But before we leave this subject, let me bring it back to Lance. And I saw you nodding your head when Dr. Fuster was talking about the bad habits that are getting picked up in the developing world, lack of exercise, obesity. And I just wonder, it always surprises me to hear that, that it's happening both here in the developing world. And how do you break through, particularly to younger people, and break those bad habits?
Well, I was nodding my head when he said they're becoming westernized, because I have three little kids, and you know, we don't have an Xbox and we don't have a PlayStation, and I sort of make my kids go out and fall down and scrape their knee and ride their bikes and swim in the pool and do what we did as kids. But the reality is that not only is the older population becoming lazier and more sedentary, but that trickles down to our children as well, and I'm talking about exercise, but that also goes to food. We always talked about in racing in terms of eating healthy. We wanted to eat close to the farm. Well, our country and our society is eating farther and farther away from the farm, which is also going to happen in other countries and other continents. And it's all about convenience, and it's all about cheap food and easy food. But all of this stuff adds up. So if you consider lack of exercise or sedentary lifestyle, poor diet, smoking, drinking, all of these bad habits, it's pretty clear what that leads to. And it's, you know, of course, it starts here, and as the world becomes modernized and westernized, they have those conveniences, and that's going to lead to a global epidemic.
And one of the things it leads to is diabetes. You've been dealing with that challenge in India. Talk to us about it.
Well, India is the world capital of diabetes. We currently have about 30 million people with diabetes, and it's expected that this number will double in the next 20 years. And it's not just a matter of individual behaviors that determine who gets diabetes, who gets heart attacks, who gets blood pressure, or who takes to tobacco smoking. There are social determinants which can be modified by policy interventions. Professor Fuster said that heart diseases are very expensive. Indeed, all affairs of the heart are expensive. But we can actually have a fair amount of control by policy interventions which help people access healthy foods, have physical activity in safe and pleasurable environments, have a tobacco-free public space, and have an advertisement ban on tobacco, for example.
So what are the policy interventions that you're talking about here specifically?
Well, let me talk about tobacco. Advertising bans, raise taxes which increase prices and make it difficult for young people and poor people to purchase tobacco. We also require restrictions or ban on access to young people. We need stronger health warnings. These are some of the measures that have been shown to be very effective. In terms of diets, we need healthier oils and healthier fats to be supplied through the food chain at affordable prices.
Are they always more expensive?
Well, unfortunately, in developing countries, they are. And you look at the West, for example, now you have removed trans fats from the food processing industry. Unfortunately, that's not so in developing countries. In Mauritius, for example, one simple policy change of substituting the ration oil from
palm oil to soy oil just by the price change mechanism encouraged people to take healthier oils, and that brought down the blood cholesterol levels across the whole population. Similarly, in Poland, the liberalization of import of fruit and vegetables and substitution of vegetable oils for animal fats in the mid-90s dramatically reduced the heart attack rates in contrast to other countries of Central and Eastern Europe. So the power that policymakers and businesses have in changing the destinies of these countries is tremendous.
And they did it with tax policy, I guess you're saying.
Absolutely. Tax policy is required to make unhealthy products like tobacco and unhealthy foods costlier and healthy products cheaper. And we do require those kind of policy interventions in order to help people to make and maintain healthy choices. And even urban planning, for example. If you create urban conditions in which people can't take a walk or cycle, and here we have Lance Armstrong as the best example of what cycling can do, but you have, unfortunately, situations where you make it extraordinarily difficult for people to have physical exercise. It is a paradox of our culture of modernity that previously people used to be paid for doing physical work. Now we have to pay for doing physical work by going to gyms and paying a fee.
You're exactly right. Dr. Fuster, you mentioned the crossover from the earlier program, and I wonder if one of the things we learned in the last panel was that you could treat these neglected or treatable diseases in clusters, and I assume the same lesson applies here.
I agree. I like to make a very strong point, actually, and that is one thing is the policymakers, and I think has been very well pointed out, the impact that they can have. But let me go into the community. We are too ambitious. What we should do is to go to the community, engage the community, make the governments and the authorities to back you up.
At what level?
Any community. We have a project in the island of Grenada in the Caribbean, 100,000 people. I call that a community. You can be the community of a neighborhood. In New York has about 7 different communities without all their roots are in their own culture. That's the way to get at. And to understand that community, one of the things that we learn in the island of Grenada, for example, is we said we are going to really prevent the disease to go from diabetes into cardiovascular events because that's the stage they are. And what we learned very rapidly is we didn't understand that culture. So we had to spend weeks to understand what is going on there. And now the point is these people in the neighborhood help each other. So I'd like to finish this comment by saying to you the following. Adults, we do not change unless there is a law, unless there is a policy, as was described. On things that we can change, we don't. But if we have our friends to support us and to go with us, that, to me, is extremely important for the future.
Is that a difference, then, between what we're talking about here and what we were talking about before? Both you and Dr. Reddy have talked about policy intervention. And it seems like because these problems are on such a grand scale and have so many different causes, that governments are going to have to deal with it, not generally private foundations or corporations on their own.
I disagree. I'm sorry.
You disagree?
I do.
Go to it. Let me hear.
First,
both do. I want to hear you both.
Well, first of all, if we go to a community, the first thing I have to do is to talk to the governor. And the next thing I need is money. Who's going to give it to me? So you cannot say that you work on a community and you don't need the private enterprise. You just need it. You don't need the private enterprise to do a magnificent thing in a huge country. You need it there, too. So I think we have to really come down to the reality and to today, the partnership, whether you work on a herd or on a neighborhood or whether you work on a community, and the authority in that community is absolutely essential to succeed.
Well, we do need policy interventions from the government to create climates conducive to healthy behaviors. But who sets the agenda for the policy? Who actually allows that policy to be implemented successfully? Ultimately, these are communities. It is the wish and the wisdom of the community that ultimately forces policymakers to implement healthy policies. And if the community also is not mentally prepared to accept policy changes, like, for example, smoke-free public places, you may enact laws, but they will never succeed. So you do require both a top-down regulatory approach as well as a bottom-up community mobilization approach. And this is where the civil society organizations need to be strengthened so that they can actually activate and mobilize the strength of the communities. That is where all the people who are gathered here can strengthen NGO capacity so that right from school children to women in the communities, to as well as other organized civil society groups, they can be strengthened in order not only to articulate the demand for healthy policies, but also to ensure their success once the policies are introduced as laws.
Yes, I want to add that usually governments, it's not in low and middle countries only, it's in high income countries too, I mean developed countries, they are not interested that much with dealing with chronic diseases prevention because it takes a long time to prevent. So you will see the outcomes very late. You will achieve them very late. And also it needs more money, I mean sustainable funds. So the problem is that they are more interested with infectious diseases. And if you see since yesterday, I was talking to my friends now, to Janet Vogt and Derek Yag, that since yesterday, we are talking about infectious diseases. All donations go to malaria, tuberculosis, I mean AIDS. I'm not against this. It's good. But we should look to the individual as one individual. I mean, if you remember the picture of the lady yesterday, that Mrs. Laura Bush, she showed a picture of a lady who was happy of having she was HIV positive, but she will not get the disease, and she was happy with that. She was obese. And I was thinking that, well, she will not get the disease. Yes, that's right. But she's obese. She will get diabetes in the future, cardiovascular disease, because this is the neglected, this is the real neglected part, which is the most important reason for mortality everywhere in the world. And governments are not interested with that. So in our situation, I'm in the Middle East area, we need some demonstration projects. We need some practical models, evidence to show to the government, and then to get their attention, to pay or to invest, to do something for prevention.
You talk about the resistance at the government level. Do you find much cultural resistance to this?
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, if you want to start something, to plan for a community-based prevention, you need to think about all levels of prevention in order to get good results. So it's primary, secondary, all these levels of prevention. You need to do a good situation analysis, to study what's going on in the community, what are the social determinants, cultural determinants, what are in favor of your interventions, what are against your interventions, in terms of everything. People belief, policies, legislations, environment, everything. It's not when we go with WHO, like we have some training courses with other countries, and we talk to the people, they say, well, the situation analysis is to look for the prevalence of the risk factors. What's the percentage of the people who are smokers, obese, having diabetes, cardiovascular disease, that's it. It's not the case. You need to think about why. What are the reasons? What's the environment? What are the policies? All these things. And then to plan for a community-based initiative or intervention strategies based on all these points and issues. And then you will get better results.
Lance, you thought a lot about this as it applies to cancer. And obviously, I know you've focused especially on prevention. We all know you don't smoke, you're less likely to get cancer. You don't go in the sun, you're less likely to get cancer. What are the other sort of rules that you've learned in your work?
I just want to say one thing about the smoking part, because I think in this country there are certain cities like Austin, Texas, where we live smoke-free, this city smoke-free. Mm-hmm. But then so that you sort of tick away a little bit city by city, but then you look at a country like Ireland, which, I mean,
free.
Any Irish people here? Start drinking Guinness like when they walk. And yet that whole country's mandates smoke-free. I think that's an amazing policy, and obviously that comes from the top down. And I think that this country should do something like that too, for something that's clearly so devastating and so strongly linked to a lot of problems, not just cancer but heart disease. All of the things that we've just discussed. So, you know, outside of that, I mean, you asked me what else we've come to know. I mean, it's simply, of course, some people are just predisposed and that's bad luck. But a lot of times, I mean, prevention and awareness is so strong and so obvious in terms of not smoking, healthy lifestyle. It's all about lifestyle. It's what you do when you wake up to when you go to bed. And then the other thing I suppose we haven't talked about is which is probably bigger in this country than some other places, is stress. I mean, as we know, stress in this country, running around and trying to live the life that you want to live is tough sometimes, as opposed to other places where life is simpler.
Simpler, but probably a little hard to get around, harder to get around. But Dr. Reddy, if you could talk about the resistance you've gotten at the government level, though, to the kinds of interventions that you think are necessary and what you've learned about how to overcome them.
Well, firstly, there has been a reluctance on part of most governments in the developing countries, just as it is there in development partners and donor communities internationally, to recognize that chronic diseases are a major threat to people in the developing countries. There is also a prior prejudice that this affects only the rich. It does not. The poor people are increasingly affected, and they're the most vulnerable victims as the epidemics advance. Even now in India, we have clear evidence that a person with a low income is about 1.5 times more likely to get a heart attack. A person with low educational status is twice as more likely to get a heart attack. And this is true of other developing countries as well. And the poor not only are more at risk, but they're also more vulnerable because they have less access to health services and unaffordable technologies. But now that the governments have begun to recognize that this is a problem and this needs to be tackled, there are policies that are being set in motion, but they need to be strengthened. And as I said, even for getting policies into place, you need to mobilize the community. In India, for example, we managed, in terms of the tobacco legislation, to mobilize young people by involving them in policy discussions related to the health of their generation, both currently and in the future. And based on these policy discussions, 25,000 school students went to the Prime Minister of India in September 1998 and said, the health of our generation is at stake. We would like you to protect it by having a comprehensive ban on tobacco advertising and then subsequently bringing about a tobacco law. By 2001, the Indian Parliament had a law introduced, and by 2003, the law was passed. And this is the same parliament in 1995 said that tobacco economics suggests that India should not have a tobacco control policy. But in 2003, the parliament passed the law unanimously. So you do require to mobilize people, especially the young people, make them stakeholders in the future, and then enable them to actually bring about policies.
Dr. Foster, if you could pick one problem to focus on, would it be tobacco?
No, the problem I see is we do not educate our children properly. In other words, the key issue to me is at age between 5 and 10, as we have learned from Sesame Street, which I am working with. This is the age where you can really model your behavior of the future. We should tell children what is good about preserving health. We should not be negative. We should be very positive. And I can tell you, our first experience in a project in Colombia is they have more influence, the children on the parents, to stop smoking than the other way around. So I think we have to learn, in the adult, we need laws. We need support from our friends. And then we change behavior.
Could you talk a little bit more about that? Because I guess I just assume intuitively that kids pay attention to what their parents do, not to what they say.
No, the kids pay. Let me tell you, the experience we have is the kids, the role model, in terms of telling them what to do, are the 15 to the 20-year-olds. They have an incredible influence. And what we are doing now, in a meeting that is coming out in India, you are involved, is we are going to teach the 15 to the 20-year-olds who coming from Latin America, a large number of people, to develop a network that will teach the children in the school systems at 5 to 10 years of age the importance of health for their lives. And that, to me, that's what we have to do, is our projects, our demonstration projects. I'm not telling you that this is the answer we have to see in a few years, but our demonstration projects like this, where we should aim at. And this is one of the projects that we are very, very involved in, and is exciting.
And I guess if that's right, that would also lead you to think of things like trying hard not to see 18-year-old girls smoke in movies. So because of the example they set.
Well, I'd like to capture your question. I'm sorry, I didn't capture what you
said. No, I was just saying, and if you turn to think of the broader culture as well,
yeah.
if these 15 to 20-year-olds are the role models, you might want to, I mean, get into issues of censorship, but get into the issue, try to convince television production companies, movie companies. I say you want to address this question to make sure that you're not seeing girls and boys that age smoking.
Well, I agree. I mean, but you see, you are touching into the key issue. There are many items that are being discussed this morning, and each of them is a project.
Right.
And this is what
right.
I'm trying to say. We cannot just give an answer to a huge problem like this. We have to take it in part, and this is basically...
Yes, I would like to add to the role models. This is very important strategy. And we use this even in our schools. So the children, we did the education for the teachers, the school children, the parents, for NCD prevent. Non-communicable diseases or chronic diseases, let me say. I don't agree with non-communicable because in my idea, as I discussed with my friends, communicable diseases is diseases which is transmitted between individuals, but chronic diseases, it's sort of communicable. That's transmitted by westernization and globalization between countries and populations.
By example.
This is what I believe. So chronic diseases, we use the role models not only in the schools, but in the work sites, for women, for NGOs, and it was very good. I mean, it was very good strategy. And we did the international quit and win contest that was done by KTL in Finland, started in 1994, a very good contest for tobacco control. More than 100 countries in the world, they participated in that. And when we distributed the announcement for participation of smokers, and we did the lottery, 8 of 10 of the winners, they said, we got the message from our children, and we stopped smoking. So the role models, the children, they it's not for them only, it's for transmission or transmitting the message to their parents and the family at all.
We've run a little bit over. Let me bring Dan Stone back up, because we're going to go to the tabletop exercises. Thank you.
Okay, so we're now ready to turn the conversation over to you folks. We recognize universally how expensive it is to treat sick people. We also widely recognize that the fundamental key to chronically ill populations is prevention. So we have a two-part question we'd like you to consider at your tables. First of all, recognizing the insufficiency of resources to manage all chronically ill patients, how can we more efficiently encourage prevention-oriented initiatives? And then, if prevention doesn't work, or where it doesn't work, what are some innovative and efficient ways of providing needed treatment for the increasing number of people with chronic diseases? You've got 25 minutes for this conversation. We'll be back up later.
Okay, we're ready for the next phase. And I have to start out with a mea culpa for Dr. Fuster. I was told that you're head of the World Health Foundation, but now I've been told it's the World Heart Federation. So excuse me for that. But let me begin by starting with the questions from the audience, one for you. And one audience member wants you to explain the benefits of the poly pill and how that is simplified treatment. And we were talking off stage. I also want you to take the opportunity to talk about what you consider a big gap in the UN Millennium Challenges.
Why a poly pill? Following a heart attack, people have to take three pills: aspirin, what we call an ACE inhibitor, and what we call a statin. And if they do that, the incidence of recurrence of a heart attack decreases by 60%. Problem: people don't take three pills a day. After a year, only 15% of the people take the three pills. Second, it's very expensive. So here's the issue. We always have to change behavior, but here is one situation that pills help. With the World Heart Federation, which, by the way, to define it, involves almost 200 cardiovascular communities and foundations for 100 countries around the world, we have the purpose of preventing and controlling heart disease and stroke in middle and low-income countries. So here we come into a middle or low-income country
with a disease that is very expensive and you need to take the pills. What can we do? Let's develop a single pill. A single pill that people will take will be more compliant. It's easier than to take three pills a day. And let's make it much cheaper. With a group of, with the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute in Spain, which I'm the director, the scientific director, and the World Heart Federation, we partner. And then we are now going into the private enterprise, and we are in the process of developing a polypill. A polypill that will be used following a heart attack and is now aiming to go to middle countries in terms of resources. The very low income countries, there are other issues that have to be approached. And we are now in the process, and we think this polypill will be probably available by late 2009-2010. And the cost, it is predicted it will be 75% lower than the cost of the three pills that are being taken today that you should take, and actually people are not taking them.
Lance, there's one here for you. They want to know, how can we get a coalition of sports and players to take a more proactive role to energize their fans, to be both personally responsible and to support public policies that would help prevent these diseases?
Stakeholders?
I guess this is for Lance first, and then we'll come to you. Go ahead.
I don't know. You know, there are a handful of athletes who are really out there on issues like that. I've tried to be out there because it affected me personally, and it's now become a new sort of competition for me because I need that in my life for whatever reason. but I think that, obviously, if they're affected, if other athletes are affected personally or a family member or somebody, that whatever the problem may be, it's accepting that. I always talk about this thing called the obligation of the cured, which my doctors told me about when I left the hospital, and they said, listen, you can accept it or not. Both are fine answers, but I accepted this obligation, and I went out and shared my story and tried to make a difference. And so it's just a question of whether or not athletes or sports stars or anybody in the public eye wants to take that on. But certainly, when you talk about role models and you talk about how that trickles down to the youth of the world, that's a powerful group of people. I mean, we were talking about young women and who they look up to. I mean, I have 5-year-old twin girls, and I can only imagine that when they're 12, who they're going to be looking up to. It's a little scary, but it's a powerful notion, and one that we certainly should look at.
Dr. Zadragan, you were talking earlier about that you don't really accept the distinction between chronic and infectious diseases. And one of the questions here is, are there ways to address these two sets of diseases simultaneously, or do we need different strategies for these for what the audience thinks is different kinds of diseases?
Usually, what's currently existed in everywhere in the world is there is a good surveillance and monitoring system for infectious diseases everywhere, which is integrated with the primary health care system or public health centers. But there is nothing about chronic diseases to be integrated within the primary health care system. So there is no preventive actions, activities.
Why is that?
That's because it's neglected diseases. This is what we said. It's not priority for governments. It's not even there are many obstacles. Even the physicians, the health professionals, we need to work with everybody to increase the awareness, to improve the awareness level, to pay attention for this priority. It's the first killer. Everybody knows that. And I like very much this, the Oxford Health Alliance theme, which is three risk factors. That's nutrition, lack of physical activity, tobacco, leading to four diseases, which is cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancer, COPDs, leading to more than 50% of the mortality in the world. So this is a very nice and small and short theme, and everybody knows this, but in reality, nothing. There was a study even done by the World Health Organization. They asked the six regions of the world, do you have any policy at the national level for tobacco, for diabetes, for cardiovascular disease? And many of the countries, they said yes. But who monitored this? Is there existing really policies for these things or not? Now, coming back to your question, Is this possible to integrate communicable and non-communicable disease together? In my idea, yes, we did that. In our demonstration project, what we did, we went to the health centers in the cities, the health houses in the rural area, who were taking care of infectious diseases and reporting and monitoring them. And we just asked few questions in the monitoring. We added some questions in the monitoring sheets. And we asked the people, the health workers and volunteers who were working there, to give 3 or 4 messages. It's not highly sophisticated to do prevention for NCDs. It started from this, going up to do many interventional strategies. Yes, it could be done, but it needs different strategies.
Dr. Reddy, you were talking earlier about the tax policies that were used to improve nutrition. But one of the questions here is, what incentives are there for food companies to play a role in preventing heart disease and diabetes in developing countries? Or how would you create these incentives?
Well, certainly we ought to create market conditions in which healthier food products can be sold in plenty at affordable rates for people, and simultaneously build consumer consciousness so that they'll opt for these healthy choices when available. So it requires both working with the food industry as well as incentivizing the production of healthier food products through some economic incentives. But it also requires a fair amount of consumer mobilization in order to provide a market for these.
Have you had any experience with that in India?
Well, not yet, but then there is, in the urban areas of India, an increasing preference now for some of the healthier oils as well as for the processed foods, which are lower in salt content as well as relatively free of trans fats and saturated fats. But again, these require some additional components like price mechanisms to be introduced through incentives. But if I may just take on the earlier question that you posed, Nizal, in terms of the way in which we can actually deal with both infectious as well as chronic diseases together. This whole business is an artificial divide. We are really looking at dealing with communicable as well as chronic diseases together. It's an and, not an or. And this is simple because if you're trying to save a child under the age of 15 years from dying of a diarrheal disease, you don't want that same child to die at the age of 30 or 35 of a heart attack prematurely. You are investing in the life of human beings. Secondly, you refer to sub-Saharan Africa as an area where chronic diseases are probably not as much of a problem. It's only relative magnitude compared to infectious diseases. For example, in Tanzania, the stroke mortality rates because of paralytic attacks in the age group of 15 to 59 in Tanzania are 3 to 4 times more than that in the United Kingdom in the same age group. So if you are really worried about a child who has lost parents because of AIDS epidemic, and the child of 10 years is under the care of a 55-year-old grandmother, and that's the sole custodian and caretaker of that child in sub-Saharan Africa, you wouldn't want that lady to have a stroke because of undiagnosed and untreated high blood pressure. So you are actually investing in both infectious as well as non-infectious diseases. Even etiologically, in terms of causation, healthy diets like fruit and vegetables prevent infections by building up immunity. They prevent chronic diseases. Similarly, we now know that smoking is a cause of tuberculosis. It increases the risk of people getting tuberculosis. So it is time that we stop thinking in terms of barriers and we really start thinking in terms of addressing all of these neglected diseases together and through community-based demonstration projects.
And with that, I want to bring the results of the tabletop discussions first, but we'll come back to you after we hear from Chris Jennings. Actually, no. I'm being told to go ahead.
You asked a second question that I didn't answer, and that is, what is the millennium? And I think it fits with everything we are discussing here. The United Nations Millennium Development Goals in the year 2000 was to have 8 achievements in the year 2015. One of them relates to disease in terms of malaria, HIV, and other diseases. Chronic diseases that we are discussing today, cancer, cardiovascular disease, respiratory diseases, which are really growing very rapidly and will have a tremendous economic impact, are not part of the millennium, have been completely ignored. And if I have to say a single thing this morning, to me would be, please, let's make chronic diseases, not just cardiovascular disease and stroke, chronic diseases part of the millennium.
Why was it left out?
How this is done? Look, there are some people here who are very influential. This is an issue of advocacy. This is an issue of awareness. And you know, when you look at the economics of what we are discussing here this morning, the impact in 10, 15 years from now, I can assure you the millennium has to take care of HIV, has to take care of malaria, has to take care of tuberculosis, absolutely. But please, let's be sure that we are aware of what is coming up here, which economically is going to be devastating. So it's a plea, I would say, on behalf of all of us who are dealing with chronic diseases.
One more minute. I guess they're still not ready. You guys must have had a lot of ideas on there. But I did ask a slightly different question, and I want to pose it to you. I don't understand why this cluster of diseases was left out of the Millennium Challenges. There must have been a reason. There must have been forces arrayed against it. And I was just wondering if you had any theory on that, or if any of you do.
Well, I think the issue is clear. We all are reactive in this world. We react to what is coming out that is important. HIV came, malaria came. It's extremely important. What happened is we don't pay enough attention to what is coming. That's the problem. And I think I think it's quite human what has occurred, but we are here to just say, please, let's think what is happening. This is at least my view of what.
Well, I think there are other issues that should be addressed. First, we are doctors, and we know what's the medical curriculum. There is nothing, or there's few things mentioned within the medical curriculum about our role in prevention. So this is the first issue that we need to include or emphasize more on the medical curricula for the physicians and health professionals. The other thing is that controlling infectious diseases is much more easier, as I said before. I mean, whether it's outbreak of SARS or whatever else, like two or three cases, everything will be arranged. I mean, the government will take care, the regional office of WHO, WHO, everywhere, they will take care to control this. But think about the huge numbers of diabetic patients or cardiovascular patients who die every day. And nobody pay attention. I mean, it's not like that much, but it's much more less than infectious diseases. Why? Because it's not very easy to give a vaccine and then control diabetes or control cardiovascular disease. It needs, what I said, a comprehensive approach. It needs public education, health professional education, training trainers, policy changes, environmental changes. And you have on the other side, you have Philip Morris for tobacco, you have McDonald's, you have fast food, you have all these things that attract many people, specifically children, youth. So the epidemic is increasing. Obesity is increasing everywhere in the world. The Western people, when we discuss, they said, the idea that they have in mind, do you have cardiovascular disease? Do you have chronic disease in Asia? Yes, we have. Come and see the Asian countries. See how much McDonald's are available over there, how much advertisement for tobacco. I mean, we're lucky in Iran, we don't have any advertisement for tobacco. But in Asian countries, in Middle East countries, the advertisement is huge. So you need to tackle all these things. It's not that much easy. So governments are interested with infectious diseases because it's easier to control. It was not neglected. Nobody was thinking about it. It's much more complex to do this with all these things that I mentioned.
Well, we're going
to
find out the solutions this group came up with right now. Chris Jennings is ready.
Thank you, George. Let me each give you. Well, I'm sorry I wasn't as fast as you want me to be, George, but just too many ideas. The themes and the nuggets were definitely substantial and very complementary, so I'll quickly go through them so you have some time to discuss them. Many were oriented towards prevention at the very beginning, teaching healthy behaviors, but through existing communities and ceremonies and institutions, much like many of the panelists have suggested. There was an interesting a couple of ideas about funding the distribution of HPV vaccines to prevent cervical cancer in developing countries to reinforce the need for primary care hopefully catching disease so you early, obviously, so you can deal with the overwhelming cost of dealing with it later. Managing the growth of cities to foster walking, biking, with public exercise facilities. This was stated quite a bit, and there was concerns raised in certain developing countries that they are actually building roads but dropping the bicycle access points, just as an example of not being able to actually pushing down any type of incentives to exercise. And this was the last point I think was important, which is prevention absolutely is key, but we have people who are sick today, and we do not manage care very well, and we can do a much better job, and we can do so efficiently. As for the nuggets, there was a very definite belief that we can do much more interventions, specifically removing vending machines, as has been the case. The Clinton Foundation has been doing work with Pepsi and others. Accelerating development of tobacco vaccine, which is now underway to a small degree. There was an interest in developing a code of conduct amongst the food companies, and it did not necessarily have to be regulatory or statutory, but definitely it had to happen. Rebrand chronic disease. This was a similar theme that we had neglected disease. Find a new name. And in this context, the suggestion was avoidable, but I'll let you respond to that. Corporations should fund healthy employee programs because it is in their interest so to do for productivity. And lastly, find the kids where the kids are. They're watching MTV, they're doing iPods, and other kids' access points that are culturally sensitive but that get to the education of those children early when they are most impacted by it. With that, I'll turn it back over.
Lots of practical and very specific solutions. Dr. Reddy, what struck you about them?
I think all of these are collectively excellent suggestions, and if they're implemented, then surely there can be a tremendous amount of difference made in a number of countries. But this also requires resourcing. We cannot push the responsibility entirely onto the governments, though governments need to act. We need to do a lot of things with the communities themselves, which means that we ought to be able to provide facilities in the communities for greater health awareness as well as greater adoption of healthier behaviors. And for this, we need demonstration projects which are aided by civil society organizations so that we can show that change can be made and the change is quite effective. And once that change is demonstrated, then both the communities themselves as well as the governments are much more likely to take it up and replicate it on a wider scale.
When you talk about demonstration projects, of the ones you're working with now, which is the project that excites you the most?
There are two projects I'm working on currently in India, and both are effective, but the one that excites me most is the one I work with school children, both in terms of awareness at the younger age group between class 6 to 8, where we say it is learning the fact, where there is health awareness at the school level and home outreach program. But with the high school children, we call it learning to act. Based on the information they've learned earlier, they become change agents in the school, in the families, in the wider community, in the neighborhood community. They become the change agents for disseminating health information, but they also undertake media advocacy and policymaker advocacy. And they take ownership of the programs. And that is what really excites me, because this is the generation that requires to be given the greatest protection against chronic diseases, and now they are taking ownership of that program. The second, of course, is we have a very wide, countrywide worksite program in which the employees as well as their families are provided health education as well as risk factor screening so that they are prevented from getting these diseases by early intervention on risk factors, and that's another effective way of handling things. Just to sum up, the question about Millennium Development Goals. The reason why people did not include chronic diseases in Millennium Development Goals was because of the misimpression that this has no relation to poverty. But if a 40-year-old foreman in a factory collapses and dies in India of a sudden cardiac death, not only is he deprived of his life, but his children and the family would be pushed into the poverty cycle. It's been shown in Bangladesh that when somebody loses a parent in midlife years, the family is more likely to have, the children are more likely to have 12 times greater poverty levels, 12 times greater likelihood of getting into poverty cycle. So you want to really ensure removal of poverty from the world, you cannot ignore chronic diseases.
Dr. Fuster, I wonder if you could pick up on this question of a tobacco vaccine. How realistic is it and how effective could it be?
It would be excellent if this is available. But let me tell you, if we just concentrate on tobacco, we are missing the game here. This is much more complicated. And one of the things that I learned from the American Heart Association is how you have to attack all the issues and look at them individually and then try to go for them. I would say to you, this summary is excellent because, in fact, it portrays what has been discussed this morning. We believe in demonstration projects, and we have one that puts all together, which is rheumatic fever in Africa. So the World Heart Federation started with a program on rheumatic fever about 2 years ago, and now is going into Egypt, Ethiopia, is going into South Africa and Ghana. And basically, this is a disease that is infectious disease and chronic disease. It starts with a sore throat, and it goes into the heart. You develop a valve that gets narrow or too open, and the patient needs surgery years afterwards. So here's a clear example of acute infectious disease and chronic. How many people? 15 million people have rheumatic fever. Two-thirds are in Africa at this moment. Now, what to do? Look, penicillin, one of the cheapest drugs available at the moment of throat, sore throat and so forth. How we approach the problem? Education to the community. The governments of these countries are involved. We go to the community, and we are now looking also for private enterprise to help. But it's an educational issue. And it actually puts together all the things that are being discussed here, the importance of the community. And, you know, the only thing we can do there is to teach them. Then they take care of themselves. And rheumatic fever and rheumatic heart disease is a clear example of how a demonstration project, community-driven, with the local authorities being involved, can be quite successful. I prefer to talk about this than just going into the vaccine against tobacco.
Okay. Dr. Zedrigan, you get the last word.
Yes. That was excellent that you mentioned the demonstration project, because this is what I believe. I mean, I usually believe in not to go to the government to start something to do, to say, well, I want to do that. Give me the money. I want to start a plan to control chronic diseases, diabetes, cardiovascular. This is not easy to do. I believe in doing, I mean, from bottom to top and top to bottom together. So you need a demonstration, a practical model to show it to the government and to do that. And we have a demonstration project as well. And we did many strategies like community participation and mobilization. Beside this, in education, whatever else, we had a very strong private-public collaboration. And we involved the decision makers and the stakeholders to be planning, to be involved in planning, implementing, and evaluating the interventions. So they feel its own. And that will make you sure that this intervention will be more sustainable when you stop your monitoring or your work, because they feel its own, it's their own, it's embedded within their systems. The stakeholders, decision makers, to be involved is a very important point.
That is the last word. Thank you all very much. We had two terrific sessions. Please give them a hand. If nothing else, we're going to have to rebrand these sessions for next year to make sure we do treatable and avoidable diseases. But there really were so many good ideas generated here. And I hope all of you will return this afternoon for session 3, which is about healthy workers and productive businesses. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.